Would I even know? Mom, Lanny says, he's kind of hot. You should check that out. Throwing up in my mouth, Connor says, wanna see? Quiet, I tell them, settling in between them on the couch. I reach for the remote, then turn and look at my son. Connor, about the phone. He braces for impact and opens his mouth to apologize. I put my hand over his and the cell he still holds tightly in it, as if it might get away. We all make mistakes. It's okay, I tell him, staring right into his eyes to make sure he understands that I'm being honest. I'm sorry I've been such a terrible mom to you recently. Both of you. I'm sorry about my freak out over the alarm. You shouldn't have to tiptoe around your own home, afraid of when I might blow up at you. I'm so sorry, honey. He doesn't know what to say to any of that. He looks helplessly at Lanny, who leans forward, brushing dark hair from her face and hooking it behind one ear. We know why you're so tense all the time, she tells me, and he looks relieved that she said it for him. Mom, I saw the letter. You've got a right to be paranoid. She must have told Connor about the letter, because he doesn't ask, and he doesn't seem curious. On impulse, I reach over and take her hand. I love these kids. I love them so much it steals my breath and squeezes me flat, and at the same time, it makes me feel weightless and exalted. I love you both, I say. Connor comfortably shifts and reaches for the remote control. We know that, he says. Don't go all unicorns pooping rainbows on us. I have to laugh. He presses the play button and we sink back into fiction again, warm and comfortable together. And I remember when they were so little I could rock Connor in my arms while Lanny fidgeted and played next to me. I miss those sweet moments. But they're also tainted. Those moments happened back in Wichita, a home I thought was safe. While I played family time, Mel had so often been absent, in his garage, working on his projects. And every once in a while he made a table, a chair, a bookcase, a toy for the kids. But in between those things, in that locked workshop, he'd let his monster loose while we were just 10 feet away, lost in the wonder of a movie or the shouting fun of a board game. He'd clean up and come out smiling. And I never knew the difference. I hadn't even wondered about any of it. It had seemed harmless, just his hobby. He'd always needed alone time, and I'd given it to him. He'd said he kept the outer door padlocked because he had valuable tools. And I'd swallowed every word of it. Living with Mel was nothing but lies, always lies, no matter how warm and comforting they had seemed. No, this is better. Better than it's ever been before. My smart, savvy kids, just the way they are. Our home that we've rebuilt with our own hands. Our new, reborn lives. Nostalgia is for normal people. And for all we pretend, as hard as we can ever pretend, we will never, ever be normal again. I pour a glass of scotch and go outside. That's where Connor finds me half an hour later. I love the quiet hush of the lake, the moonlight on the water, the sharp crispness of stars overhead. Soft breezes sway and whisper the pines. The scotch provides a nice counterpoint, a memory of smoke and sunlight. I like finishing the day this way, when I can. Connor, still in his pants and a t-shirt, slides into the other chair on the porch and sits in silence for a moment before he says, Mom, I didn't lose my phone. I turn toward him, surprised. The scotch sloshes a little in the tumbler and I put it aside. What do you mean?
I mean, I didn't lose it. Somebody took it.
Do you know who?
Yeah, he says. I think Kyle took it.
Kyle?
Graham, he says. Officer Graham's kid. The taller one, you know? He's 13.
Honey, it's okay if it fell out of your pocket or your backpack. It was an accident.
I promise I'm not going to bust you for it, all right? You don't have to accuse anybody just to...
You're not listening, Mom, he says fiercely. I didn't lose it.
If Kyle stole it, why would he give it back to you? Connor shrugs. He looks pale and tense, old for his age.
Maybe he couldn't get it unlocked. Maybe his dad caught him with it. I don't know.
He hesitates.
Or maybe he got what he wanted off it. Like Lanny's number. He was asking me about her.
That's normal, of course. A boy asking about a girl. Maybe I'd misinterpreted her friendliness toward Officer Graham. Maybe I hadn't spotted a sudden infatuation. Maybe she just wanted to get to know his son. She could do worse, I thought. But what if he did steal the phone? How is that okay?
You could be wrong, baby, I say. Not everything has to be a threat or a conspiracy.
We're okay. We'll be okay. He wants to tell me something else. I can see it in his body language. He's also afraid that I'll be angry at him. I hate that I've made him afraid to tell me things.
Connor, sweetie, what's bothering you?
He bites his lip.
Nothing, Mom. Nothing.
My son's worried. I've created a world for him where defaulting to a conspiracy theory makes sense to him.
Is it okay if I just stay away from them, though, Kyle and his brother?
If you want to, of course. But be polite, all right? He nods, and after a second I pick up my scotch again. He stares out at the lake.
I don't need friends anyway.
He's too young to say that. Too young to even think it. I want to tell him that he should make all the friends he can, that the world is safe and no one will ever hurt him again, that his life can be full of joy and wonder. And I can't tell him that, because it isn't true. It might be true for other people, not for us. Instead, I finish my scotch. We go inside. I set the alarm, and once Connor is in bed, I take all my guns to the kitchen table, lay out the cleaning kit, and make sure that I'm ready for anything. Like practicing my aim, cleaning my weapons feels soothing. Feels like putting things right again. I need to be ready, just in case. Lanny spends the rest of her suspension acing her homework and reading, headphones blasting, though she does go running with me twice. She even does it voluntarily, though by the end of the run she's swearing she'll never do it again. On Saturday we call my mother. It's a family ritual, the three of us gathered around my disposable phone. I have an app built in that generates an anonymous voice over IP number, so that even if anyone is reviewing my mom's call logs, the number won't lead them anywhere close. I dread Saturdays, but I know the ritual is important for the kids. Hello? My mother's calm, slightly fragile voice reminds me of her advancing years. I always picture her as she was when I was younger, healthy, strong, tanned, lean from all her swimming and boating. She lives in Newport, Rhode Island now, having left Maine behind. She had to move before my trial, and twice after it. But finally people are leaving her alone. It helps that Newport has that New England closed-in attitude. Hi, Mom, I say, feeling the uncomfortable pressure in my chest. How are you?
I'm fine, honey, she says.
She never says my name. At 65 years old, she's had to learn to be so cautious about talking to her own child.
So glad to hear your voice, sweetheart. Everything okay there?
She doesn't ask where we are, and she never knows.
Yes, we're fine, I tell her.
I love you, Mom.
Love you too, sweetheart.
I ask her about her life there, and she talks with false enthusiasm about restaurants and picturesque views and shopping, about taking up a scrapbooking hobby, though what she can scrapbook about me, I have no idea. The reams of articles about my monstrous ex, my trial, my acquittal. It's almost as bad if she doesn't include any of that, and only has my pictures up to my wedding, pictures of the kids, without any context for our lives. I wonder what kind of decorations Hobby Lobby sells to ornament the pages dedicated to serial killers in a scrapbook. Lanny leans over to say, in a bright voice, Hi, Grandma. And when my mother responds, I hear the shift in that faraway voice. Real warmth. Real love. Real connection. It skips a generation, or at least, it skipped over me. Lanny loves her grandmother, and so does Connor. They remember those dark, awful days after the event, when I was dragged off to jail, and the only light left for them was my mom, who'd swept in like an angel. She'd rescued them into something like normalcy, at least for a while. She'd been a lioness in their defense, fending off reporters and the curious and vindictive with sharp words and slammed doors. I owe her for that. I almost miss it when she says, So kids, what are you studying in school right now? It seems like a safe question, and it should be. But as Connor opens his mouth, I realize that one of his classes is Tennessee history, and I quickly interrupt. Classes are going well. She sighs, and I can hear the exasperation in it. She hates this, hates being so vague. And how about you, dear? Have you got any new hobbies? Not really. That's the extent of our conversation. We were never quite close, she and I, even when I was a child. She loves me, I know, and I love her. But it isn't the kind of attachment that I see in other people, other families. There's a kind of polite distance between us, as if we're strangers who happened to end up together. It's odd. But I owe her everything, even so. She'd never expected to have to keep my children for nearly a year while the prosecution tried to build a case for my guilt. They called me Melvin's little helper, and my presumed involvement in Melvin's crimes rested completely on the testimony of one gossipy, vindictive neighbor. Looking for attention. She claimed she'd seen me help Melvin carry one of his victims from the car into the garage one evening. I never had. I never would. I hadn't known a thing ever. But it was horrifying and maddening to realize that no one, absolutely no one, believed that. Not even my own mother. Maybe part of the open wound between us stems from that moment when she'd asked me, with such revulsion and horror in her face, Honey, did you do this? Did he make you do this? She'd never insisted it was a lie, never denied I was capable of atrocity. She'd only sought to find a reason for it, and that was incredibly hard to understand, then or now. Maybe it was the lack of attachment she'd had to me as a child, and I to her. Maybe she could so easily believe the worst because she felt she'd never really known me at all. I will never, ever do that to my children. I will defend them with complete devotion. None of this is their fault. My own mother has always blamed me. Well, she told me at one point, you wanted to marry the man. The reason the trolls are so viciously devoted to my pursuit is that they really believe that I'm guilty. I'm a vicious, predatory killer who managed to evade justice, and now they're the ones who can administer the punishment. On some level, I understand it. Mel swept me off my feet with romantic gestures. He took me to beautiful dinners, bought me roses, always opened doors for me, sent me love letters and cards. I really did love him, or at least I thought I did. The proposal was thrilling. The wedding was fairy tale perfect. In a few months we were pregnant with Lily, and I thought I was the luckiest woman in the world, someone whose husband earned enough to let her stay home and lavish her children with love and care. And then, gradually, his hobby had crept in. Mel's workshop had started small. A workbench in the garage, then more tools, more space, until there wasn't room for even one car, much less two, and he'd built the carport and taken the entire garage as his space. I hadn't loved it, especially in the winter, but by then Mel had taken out the garage door, built a back wall, and added a door that he kept padlocked and deadbolted. Expensive tools. I'd never noticed anything that had sounded odd. Except once. It would have been around the death of his next-to-last victim. He'd told me that a raccoon had gotten into the workshop from the attic and died in the corner, and it would take a while for the smell to air out. He used lots of bleach and cleaners. I believed every word of it. Why wouldn't I? But I still think I should have known, and in that I understand the troll's anger. My mother is saying something that, by the tone, is directed again to me. I open my eyes and say, "Sorry, what?" "I said, are you making sure the kids are getting swimming lessons? I worry that you're not, given the problems you have." My mother adores the water, lakes, pools, the sea. She's half mermaid. It was especially horrifying to her that Melvin disposed of his victims in water. It's especially horrifying to me, too. My stomach clenches when I even think of dipping a toe in the lake that I admire so much from a distance. I can't even take a boat out on that calm surface without thinking of my ex-husband's victims, weighted down and chained to the bottom. A silent, rotting garden, swaying in the slow currents. Even drinking tap water makes me gag. "The kids aren't really interested in swimming," I tell my mom, without the slightest inflection of dismay that she brought up the subject at all. "We do run pretty often, though." "Yeah, the path around," Lanny starts, and lightning fast, I reach out and hit the mute button. She realizes her mistake in the next instant. She'd been about to say the lake, and even though there are thousands of lakes in the country, it's a clue. We can't afford even that much. "Sorry." I unmute. "I mean, we run outside a lot," Lanny says. "It's nice." It's hard for her not to be able to provide any details. The temperature, the trees, the lake. But she leaves it at that. Generic. My mother knows enough not to push. It's a sad fact of life. I've wondered before what their life was like without me. My own experience behind bars was hell, constantly burning with fear for my kids. I thought from the glad way they always greeted these phone calls that Grandma represented something peaceful in their lives, a vacation from the awful reality they've been shoved into. At least, I hope that's what it is. I hope that my kids aren't that good at lying, because that, too, is a Melvin Royal signature trait. Mom spins tales of Newport in the coming summer, and we can't reciprocate with what the weather will be like near us. She knows that, and the conversation is mostly one-sided. I wonder if she gets anything out of these calls, really, or if it's a duty for her. She might not have bothered if it had only been me, but she truly does love my kids, and they love her back. The kids' faces dim a little when I end the call and put the phone away until next time. Lanny says, "I wish we could Skype or something so we could see her." Connor immediately frowns at her. "You know we can't," he says. "They'd figure stuff out from Skype. I see it on cop shows and things." "Cop shows aren't reality, dumbass," Lanny shoots back. "You think CSI is a documentary?" "Easy, you two," I say. "I wish we could see her, too. But this is good, right? We're good." "Yeah," Connor says. "We're good." Lanny says nothing. Sicko Patrol the next day yields nothing much new, but then again I've grown so accustomed to the general horror of it that I'm not sure if I'd recognize new if it bit me. I do some freelance editing work, then some freelance web design work, and I'm deep into an especially demanding piece of coding when a brisk knock strikes the front door. Despite my startled flinch, the sound reminds me of the way Officer Graham knocks, so I am cheerful when I head to answer it. Sure enough, as I check to see who it is, I see Lancel Graham's face. After the first rush of relief, I hope he hasn't misunderstood my warm welcome the other night, or seen it as an opportunity. I'm not in a place that needs romance. I had enough of that with Mel's letter-perfect seduction, his model husband performance art. I don't trust myself that way anymore, and I can't bring myself to allow the lowering of barriers that comes with even the most casual of relationships. I'm busy thinking about that as I disarm the system and open the door, but that train of thought hardly even leaves the station. There's something different about him this time. He's not smiling. He's also not alone.
Ma'am?
The man standing behind him is the one who speaks first. He's an African-American man of medium height who has the build of a former football player, going soggy around the middle. He's got a sharp-edged haircut and heavy-lidded eyes, and the suit looks hard-worn and off the rack on its best day. He's got a tie on, too, a blunt red thing that just slightly clashes with the gray of the jacket.
"I'm Detective Prester. I need to speak with you, please."
It isn't a question. I freeze in place and involuntarily look back over my shoulder. Connor and Lanny are both in their rooms, and neither of them has come looking. I step out and shut the door behind me.
"Detective, of course. What is it?"
Thank God I don't have to fear for the safety of my children in that moment. I know where they are. I know they're safe. So this, I think, must be about something else. I wonder if he's dug around and put the trail together to connect Gwen Proctor to Gina Royal. I hope to hell not.
Can we sit down a moment?
I indicate the chairs on the porch instead of letting them inside, and he and I settle into them. Officer Graham lingers at a distance, watching the lake. I follow his gaze and my heart speeds up with a click. The usual fleet of pleasure craft is absent today. Instead, there are two boats out near the middle of the calm surface, both painted in official blue and white colors, with light bars on top that strobe slow red flashes. I see a diver in scuba gear pitch backward over the side of the second one.
"A body was found in the lake early this morning," Detective Prester says. "Was hoping you might have seen something out there last night, heard something. Anything out of the ordinary?"
I scramble to order my thoughts. Accident, I think. Boating accident. Somebody out at night, drunk, tips over the side.
"I'm sorry," I say. "Nothing unusual."
"You hear anything after dark last night? Boat engines, maybe?"
"Probably, but that's not really unusual," I say. I'm trying to remember. "Yes. I heard something around 9, I think.
Long after dark, which falls early behind the pines. But there are people who go out to enjoy the stars or do some night fishing."
"Did you happen to look outside at any point? See anyone around the lake or on it?"
He looks tired, but there's a sharpness behind that facade, one I wouldn't want to play around trying to avoid. I answer him as honestly as I can.
"No, I didn't. I'm sorry. I was working really late last night on the computer, and my office window looks up the hill, not down. I didn't go outside."
He nods and makes some notes in a book. He's got a quiet sort of confidence, the kind that makes you want to relax around him. I know that's dangerous. I've been lulled into underestimating police before, and I suffered for it.
"Anybody else in the house last night, ma'am?"
"My kids," I say.
He glances up and his eyes flash dark amber in the sunlight. Unreadable. Behind that disguise of the tired, slightly frayed, overworked man, he's sharp as a scalpel.
"Can I talk to them, please?"
"I'm sure they don't know anything."
"Please."
It would seem suspicious not to agree, but I'm tense and anxious as hell. I don't know how Lanny and Connor will react to being questioned again. They'd been subjected to many, many interviews during the course of Mel's trial and my own, and even though the Wichita police had been careful about it, it left scars. I don't know what kind of traumas it will tear open. I try to keep my voice calm.
"I'd rather not have them questioned, Detective, unless you think it's absolutely necessary."
"I think it is, ma'am."
"For an accidental drowning?"
His amber eyes fix on me, and they seem to glow in the light. I feel them probing into me like searchlights.
"No, ma'am," he says. I never said it was accidental. Or a drowning. I don't know what that means, but I feel the pit open under me. I feel the drop. Something very bad has just begun. And I say in a half whisper, I'll get them. 3. Connor goes first, and the detective is gentle with him, good with kids. I see the gleam of a wedding ring, and I'm glad that he isn't like the cops back in Kansas. My kids had developed a real fear of police, and for very good reason. They'd seen the anger of the ones who'd arrested Mel, an anger that had only increased as the depth and breadth of his crimes was revealed. Those police had known not to take it out on small children, but some of it had spilled over, inevitably. Connor seems tense and nervous, but he gives his answers in short, effective sentences. He hasn't heard anything except, as I'd said, maybe a boat engine out on the water around 9 at night. He didn't look out, because it isn't unusual. He doesn't remember anything out of the ordinary at all. Lanny doesn't want to say anything. She sits silently, head down, and nods or shakes her head, but won't speak until the detective finally turns to me in exasperation. I put a hand on her shoulder and say, "Sweetheart, it's okay. He's not here to hurt anybody. Just tell him anything you might know, okay?" I say that, of course, confident that she doesn't know anything, no more than Connor or I do. Lanny shoots me a doubtful look from a veil of dark hair and says, "I saw a boat last night." I am rooted to the spot in shock. I shiver a little, even though the day's air is warm, the birds singing. "No," I think. "No, this can't be happening. My daughter can't be a witness." A sick abyss opens at my feet, and I imagine her on the stand, testifying, cameras flashing, pictures in newspapers, and immediately, the headlines. Serial killer's daughter, witness in murder trial. We'll never get away again.
"What kind of boat?" Detective Prester asks. "How big was it? What color?"
"It wasn't very big. A small fishing boat, like..." She thinks, then points to one that's bobbing at a dock not far away. "Like that one. White, I could see it from my window."
"Can you recognize it if you see it again?"
She's already shaking her head by the time he finishes. "No, no, it was just a boat, like 100 other ones. I didn't see it real well." She shrugs. "Looked like every other one around here, honestly." If Prester is disappointed, he doesn't look it. Doesn't look excited, either.
"So you saw the boat. Good. Let's back up. What made you look outside?"
Lanny sits for a moment, thinking, then says, "I guess it was the splash?" That gets his attention and mine. My mouth goes dry. Prester leans forward a bit.
"Tell me about that."
"Well, I mean, it was a big splash. Big enough that I heard it. But my room faces the lake, you know, at the corner of the house. I had my window open, so I heard a splash when the engine cut out. I thought maybe somebody fell in or jumped in. People go skinny dipping out there sometimes."
"And you looked out?"
"Yeah, but all I saw was the boat. It was just sitting there. There was somebody in it, I guess, because after a couple of minutes, the engine started up again. I couldn't really see them." She takes in a deep breath. "Did I see somebody dumping a body?" Prester doesn't answer that. He's busy writing in his notebook, fast scratches of pen on paper. He says,
"Did you see where the boat went after the engine started?"
"No, I shut the window. It was getting too windy outside. I pulled the curtain and went back to reading."
"Okay. How long would you say you heard the engine run before it was turned off again?"
"I don't know. I put my earbuds in. I fell asleep and they were still in. My ears were sore this morning. My music played all night." God, I can't swallow. I stare at Prester, willing him to say something comforting, something like, "It's okay, kid. Nothing happened. It's all just a mistake." But he doesn't.
He doesn't confirm or deny. He just clicks his pen, puts it back in his pocket with the notebook, and stands up.
Thank you, Atlanta. That's real helpful. Miss Proctor?
I can't say anything to him. I just nod like Lanny does, and we watch as he and Graham rendezvous back at the dust-filmed black sedan parked in our driveway. They talk, but I can't make out a word, and they're positioned so we can't see their faces. I sit down and put my arm around my daughter, and for once, she doesn't shrug it off and move away. I gently rub my palm back and forth across her shoulder, and she sighs.
This isn't good, Mom.
Not good. I should have said I didn't see anything. I thought about lying, I really did. I think that's probably true. I don't see how what she saw advances the investigation at all. She couldn't identify the boat, hadn't seen anyone to recognize, and telling Prester anything just means that he'll check us out in more detail. I pray that Absalom's work on our new identities will hold up. I can't be absolutely sure of that, and any scrutiny, any leaks, could have dire consequences. We should get out of here before something happens. I think about that. I vividly imagine the flurry of packing. We have a fair amount of stuff now, and I can't ask my kids to continue to abandon everything they love. We have to take things, and that means more room than the Jeep can provide. We need something larger. A van, probably. I can trade for one, but my cash supply isn't unlimited, and my credit is carefully managed under my new identity, with only one card, and only to prop up the illusion. We can't just pull out at a moment's notice, drift away without a trace. It will take a day, at least, to get everything organized. I realize with a shock that for all my paranoia, I haven't considered this worst-case scenario— how to pull us safely and quickly out of this home, this place. A day's delay might be nothing to most people, but it could mean the difference between life and death to us. The Jeep, too small for an immediate evacuation, was a sign that I'm putting down roots and getting comfortable. And it's the wrong time for that. Damn it. Lanny, I realize, has been watching me. Watching my face as I think this through. She says nothing until Officer Graham and Detective Prester are in the sedan and backing down the drive in a whisper of pale dust, and then she says in a dead little voice, "So I guess we pack, right? Just what we can carry?" I hear the damage I've done to them both in her flat intonation. She's become resigned to the terrible, inhuman idea that she can never have friends or family or even favorite things. And she's learned to live with that at the tender age of 14. And I can't. I can't do it to her again. This time we won't run. This time I will trust Absalom's false identities. This time I will bet on normal life for once, and not rip my children's souls apart to save their physical bodies. I don't like it. But that has to be my decision. No, sweetheart. I tell her. We stay. Whatever comes, I tell myself. We aren't running away from it. I avoid any encounters for the next few days, quite successfully. Our runs around the lake are done at a pace that discourages others from chatting, and I don't do any neighborly visiting. I'm not the cookie-baking kind of mother on my best days. Not anymore. That was Gina, God rest her soul. Lanny goes back to school, and though I wait tensely for the phone to ring, she isn't in trouble again in the first few days. Or the next. The police don't return for another chat, and slowly, slowly, my anxiety levels begin to gear down. It's the following Wednesday that I get a text from Absalom, marked with his standard A as a signature. It's just a web address, and I type it into the browser on my computer. It's a newspaper story from Knoxville, quite a bit distant from us, but it's about Stillhouse Lake. Murder at isolated lake community stuns residents. My mouth goes dry, and I shut my eyes for a moment. The letters glow randomly against my eyelids, and I can't seem to banish them, so I open and look again. The headline's still there. Beneath, with no reporter byline, sits a story that must have been cribbed from a wire service, and I slowly scroll down past blinking reminders to subscribe, to read the weather, to buy a heating pad and a pair of high-heeled shoes. I finally arrive at the text of the story. It isn't much. When residents of the small town of Norton, Tennessee, woke to the news of a body in local Stillhouse Lake, no one expected it to be a murder. "We just thought it was a boating accident," said Matt Ryder, manager of the local McDonald's restaurant. "Maybe a swimmer who had a cramp and drowned. I mean, that happens. But this? Just can't believe it. This is a good little town." "Good little town" describes Norton well. It's typical of the area, a sleepy village struggling to reinvent itself for the modern age, where the old-time soda palace occupies space next to Spacetime, an internet cafe and coffee bar. One caters to nostalgia for a time gone by. The other strives for all the conveniences of a much larger town. On the surface, Norton looks successful, but digging deeper reveals a problem facing many rural areas— opioid addiction. Norton, by best estimates of local law enforcement, has a significant addiction problem, and drug trafficking is common.
"We do our best to control the spread of it," said Chief of Police Orville Stamps. "Used to be meth cooking was the worst of it, but this oxy and heroin problem is something else, harder to find and harder to stop."
Chief Stamps believes that drugs could have played a factor in the death of the still unidentified woman whose body was found floating in Stillhouse Lake last Sunday morning. She is described as a Caucasian with short red hair, between 18 and 22 years of age. She has a small scar that indicates removal of a gallbladder and a large, colorful tattoo of a butterfly on her left shoulder blade. At press time, there was no official identification, though sources inside the Norton Police Department say there is a strong likelihood the victim is from the area. Officials are keeping silent on the cause of the woman's death, though they have classified it as homicide and are interviewing residents of the Lakeside community, a formerly exclusive, wealthy area fallen, like most of the state, on harder times, to discover who, if anyone, might have information to lead to the identity of the victim or killer. They believe that the body was placed into the water after death, and say the killer attempted to weigh it down.
"Pure luck, it didn't work," said Chief Stamps. "She was roped to a concrete block, but the propeller of the boat must have cut one of the ropes when he started the engine, and up she came in the end."
The Stillhouse Lake area was known as a rustic retreat for locals until the mid-2000s, when a development company sought to reinvent the lake as a high-end refuge for upper-middle-class and upper-class families seeking lakefront second homes. The effort was only partially successful, and the gates to Stillhouse Lake are now open to anyone. Many of the wealthy have fled to more exclusive enclaves, leaving behind retirees, original residents, and empty homes sold at foreclosure auctions. While it's known among residents to be a peaceful place, the influx of new residents, renters, and buyers has made some uneasy.
"I have to believe that somebody up there saw something," Chief Stamps said, "and somebody will come forward to give us what we need to solve this case. Until then, nights on peaceful Stillhouse Lake will remain as they always have been, dark."
I roll my chair back as if retreating from the article. It's about us, about Stillhouse Lake. But even more than that, what strikes me is what likely caught Absalom's attention as well, the way the killer weighed down the body, and the age and description of the victim. It rings some kind of bell, something distant, but I can't lay hands on a memory to go with it. It also sounds eerily like the young women Melvin abducted, raped, tortured, mutilated, and buried in his own watery garden. Tied to concrete blocks. I tried to get control of myself, my racing mind. It's a coincidence, obviously. Disposing of a body in water is hardly unique, and most smart killers try to weigh them down to delay discovery. Concrete blocks, I remember from Melvin's trial, aren't unusual either. But that description... No. Young, vulnerable women are the favorite target of many serial killers. Not definitive in any way. And there's nothing to say it is a serial killer. Could have been a suspicious death gone wrong, a panic to hide a body, an inexperienced, unprepared murderer who hadn't planned to kill at all. The story more or less alludes to drugs, and there is a drug problem in Norton. We heard that from Officer Graham. The murder must be, as suggested, tied to that. Nothing to do with us. Nothing to do with Melvin Royal's crimes. But murder, practically at your front door? Again? It's a terrifying prospect, for many reasons. I fear for my kids' personal safety, of course, but I also fear for the torment that we'll go through if we are branded again as royals. I'd made the decision to stay and tough it out, but that is harder now, in the face of this story. The Sicko Patrol will notice. They'll dissect every detail, look for photos. I can't control pictures others take. No doubt I appear in the background of someone shot at the park, or the parking lot, or the school. If I don't, then Lanny does, or Connor. This has just made staying extraordinarily risky. I text back to Absalom. Why'd you send? Similarities. You saw, right? I didn't tell Absalom where we'd settled, but I suspect he knows. I had to file paperwork to buy this house under the identity he made for me. It'd be child's play for him to find out my exact address. He was the one who sent me lists of likely destinations when I'd had to flee last time. Still, it helps me to think he doesn't know, or care, where exactly we are. He's never betrayed us. He's only helped us. But that doesn't mean I can bring myself to trust him completely. Doesn't seem relevant, I tell him. Weird, though. Keep an eye. Wilco. Absalom ends the conversation, and I sit for a long time, staring at the words on the computer screen. I wish I could feel some sympathy for the poor, dead, unknown woman who was found in the lake, but she's just an abstract. A problem. I can only think that her death leads to pain for my kids. I was wrong to make a knee-jerk decision to stay here. Never close off escape. That's been my mantra for years now, and it's pure survival instinct. I'm not reversing my decision, exactly. But this article, the similarities to my ex-husband's crimes, it's woken something uneasy in me that I've learned to heed. I won't uproot my kids on a whim and run, but I damn well need to make plans to do an emergency bug out in case things turn ugly. Yes, I do owe it to my kids to provide them a stable upbringing, but even more than that, always, I owe them safety. I no longer feel the safety I did before in the face of that story. It doesn't mean I'm running, but it means I need to prepare. I quickly Google vans available for purchase in the area and come up gold. There's a large cargo van for sale or trade just a few miles away, in Norton. I think ahead to packing materials. We have collapsible plastic crates for some things, but I'll need to add a few more from the local Walmart. I try to avoid big box stores, since it means being recorded on surveillance cameras, but there isn't a whole lot of choice around Norton, unless I want to make the drive to Knoxville for supplies. I look at the clock and decide there isn't time to be DEFCON 1 paranoid. I grab a large-billed trucker hat with no logo on it and a pair of large sunglasses. I make sure my clothes are as anonymous as possible. Best I can do as a disguise. I am retrieving cash from the safe. I hear the honk of the post office delivery van down the drive and look out. He's finished filling my box, and I go out to grab the contents, still thinking hard about what has to be done to prep for an emergency. Selling the house wouldn't come into the calculation. It would have to be done post-move anyway. I'd have to pull the kids out of school without warning or explanation. Again.
But other than those considerations, we don't have a hell of a lot of ties to break, really. I've kept us mobile for so long. Keeping things light is still natural for all of us. I'd thought this would be the place where we'd get to break that cycle. Maybe it still is, but I need to be practical. Escape needs to be a viable option. Always. Step one is getting the van. There's an official type letter in my mess of circulars and junk mail. State of Tennessee. I rip it open and find my license to carry. Thank God. I put it in my wallet immediately, dump the rest of the junk mail in the trash, and retrieve my gun and shoulder holster from the safe, too. Feels good putting it on, feeling the weight, and knowing that unlike other times I've worn it, I actually have the paper to show I'm legally allowed. I've practiced drawing out of this holster many times, so there's nothing odd about it at all. Feels like an old friend at my side. I add a light jacket to conceal the gun and head out in the Jeep to buy the van. It's a long drive into the country outside Norton, and though I've printed turn-by-turn directions, the downside of refusing to join the smartphone revolution is a reliance on maps and paper. It's still a confusing mess to get to the listed destination. There's a reason, I think, that scary movies are so often set out in the woods. There's a brooding, primitive power out here, a sense of being made so small and vulnerable. The people who thrive here are strong. It catches me by surprise to find, once I've arrived at the address of the van for sale, that the name on the mailbox of the 1950s-era cabin, small, sturdy, rustic as hell, is Esperanza. Norton and Stillhouse Lake isn't an area that boasts a large Hispanic population, and I realize that it has to be Javier Esperanza's home, my range instructor, former Marine. I feel instantly comforted and at the same time strangely guilty. I won't cheat him, of course, but I hate to imagine his disappointment, his anger, if he finds out later just who I am. If the worst happens, I bug out, and he wonders if I'm fleeing in the van he sold me for even worse reasons than being married to a serial killer. I don't want to lose Javi's good opinion, but I will, for the sake of my kids' future and safety. I absolutely will. I get out and walk to the gate, where I'm greeted by a muscular bristle of brown and black fur. The dog comes armed with a fusillade of barks as loud as the gun range. The Rottweiler stands waist-high to me, but when he puts his front paws on the top of the fence, he's as tall as I am. He looks like he could rip me to dog food in under 10 seconds, and I'm very careful to stop where I am and make no threatening moves. I don't make eye contact. Dogs can take it as aggressive. The barking brings Javier to the door. He's wearing a plain gray T-shirt, soft from years of laundry, equally well-worn jeans, and a pair of heavy boots, which is sensible out here in the country, where timber rattlers and old forgotten pieces of metal are equal risks to unprotected feet. He's also drying his hands on a red dish towel, and when he sees me, he grins and whistles. At the sound of the whistle, the dog backs off and retreats to the porch, where it lies down, panting happily. "Hey, Miss Proctor," Javi says, coming to open the gate. "Like my security system." "Effective," I say, eyeing the dog carefully. It seems perfectly friendly now. "I'm sorry to bother you at home, but I guess you have a cargo van for sale?"
Oh yeah. Almost forgot, to be honest. Used to belong to my sister, but she dumped it on me when she joined up and shipped out last year. I've got it back here in the garage. Come on back."
He leads me around the side of the cabin, past a chopping block for firewood with an axe still embedded in the stump, and an old, weathered outhouse. I cast it a look, and he laughs.
"Yeah, not in use for decades. I poured concrete in the hole and floored it, and use it for tool storage now. But, you know, I like preserving the past."
He must, because garage is a generous description. What I actually see is a barn that looks as vintage as the outhouse, original to the property, I think.
horse stalls have been knocked down to fit in a long, blocky cargo van. It's an older model, the paint gone milky and matte instead of shiny, but the tires are in good shape, which is important to me. Spiders have chained the whole thing to the ground in a wispy net. Shit, Javi says, picking up a broom to scythe through the silky webbing.
Sorry, haven't checked it in a while. They can't get inside it, though.
That sounds more aspirational than factual, but I don't let it bother me. He retrieves a key from a hook on the wall, opens the door, and starts the van up. It catches almost immediately, and the engine sounds well-tuned and smooth. He lets me climb in, and I like what I see. Middling mileage, all the gauges reading clear. He flips the hood to let me take a look, and I check the hoses for any signs of cracking or crumbling.
Looks great, I say, reaching in my pocket. Trade me for the Jeep and 1,000 cash?
He blinks, because he knows how much I've put into the Jeep. For a start, I've installed the gun safe in the back, which he helped me source.
No, seriously.
Seriously.
No offense, but why? That's a sweet trade. Terrain you have around the lake, the Jeep's a better vehicle.
Javi isn't stupid, which is a little unfortunate right now. He knows he's getting the better part of this deal, and there is little to no reason for me to be swapping an environmentally appropriate Jeep for a big, clumsy cargo van, not at Stillhouse Lake. Honestly, I don't ever go off-roading, really, I tell him. And I'm thinking of moving eventually. If we do, we have way too much stuff for the Jeep. The van makes more sense.
Moving, he repeats.
Wow. I didn't know you were thinking about that. I shrug, keeping my eyes on the van and my expression as neutral as I can.
Yeah, well, things happen.
You can't always predict what comes next.
So, what do you think?
Want to take a look at the Jeep?
He waves that aside.
I know the Jeep. Look, Miss Proctor, I trust you. I need 1,000 to give my sister, and I keep the Jeep. She'll be fine with that. I take out my wallet and count out the money. It's less than I expected to pay, and I'm relieved. More for us to use when we have to reinvent ourselves, create new names and backgrounds. Javi accepts, and we sign over titles to each other. I'll have to get the ownership switched officially later. But for now, that'll do. He writes a receipt for me, and I make one for him while sitting at his small kitchen table. He still has the dish towel over his shoulder, and I notice that it matches a red and white checked one on a rack over the sink. The place looks clean and orderly, with just a few ornaments and colors among the beiges and dark browns. He still has suds in one side of the dual sink. I caught him washing dishes as I arrived. It seems like a nice place. Calm. Centered. Like Javi himself.
Thanks for everything, I tell him, and I mean it. He's treated me well since the beginning. It matters in a life like mine, where I was never treated as just myself. I was always my father's daughter, then Melvin's wife, then Lily and Brady's mother, and then, to many, a monster who'd escaped justice, not a person in my own right ever. It has taken work to get to this point where I feel entirely myself, and I cherish it. I like being Gwen Proctor, because real or not, she is a full and strong person, and I can rely on her.
Thanks for this, Gwen. I'm real happy about the Jeep, Javi says, and I realize for the first time he's called me by my first name. In his mind, we're now equal.
I like it.
I extend my hand and we shake, and he holds on just a little longer than is necessary before he says,
Seriously, you in some kind of trouble?
Because you can tell me if you are.
I'm not, and I'm not looking for a knight to come riding to the rescue, Javi.
Oh, I know. I just want to make sure you know you can always ask me if you need help.
He clears his throat.
Some people, for instance, don't want anybody to know where they're going when they leave town, or what they're driving. And I'm cool with that.
I send him a curious look. Even if I'm wanted?
Why,
Are you guilty of something? On the run from something?
His tone sharpens just a bit, and I see that it bothers him.
Yes, and yes. But the guilt is nebulous, not actual, and I'm not on the run from the law, just from the lawless.
Let's just say I might have someone trying to find me when I leave, I say.
Look, you do what you gotta do. I'm not about to ask you to go against your ethics, Javi.
I swear.
And I promise you, I haven't done anything wrong.
He nods slowly, considering it.
He finally realizes he's still got the dish towel, and I like the self-deprecating grin as he flips it toward the sink, where it lands in a heap. I wish he hadn't done it, because suddenly, strikingly, it looks like a disembodied lump of bloody flesh, out of place in this clean kitchen. I let out my breath slowly, hands flat on the table.
You pass all the background checks to get your carry permit, he says. Far as I know, you're legal as hell, so I got no problem telling people I don't know where you go when you leave here. And I don't have to tell them about the van. Don't ask, don't tell. You hear me?
I hear you.
Got a few buddies who live off the grid. You know how to do that?
I nod without telling him how long I've been moving, running, avoiding. Without telling him anything at all, which he likely doesn't deserve. Javi is trustworthy, nothing but, and yet I can't bring myself to disclose things to him about Melvin, about myself. I don't want to see him disappointed.
We'll be okay, I tell him, and manage to summon up a smile. This isn't our first rodeo.
Ah.
Javi sits back, dark eyes going even darker.
Abuse?
He doesn't ask by whom, or whether it's me, the kids, or all of us. He just leaves it there, and I slowly nod, because it's true. In a way, Mel had never conventionally abused me. He'd certainly never hit me. He'd never even verbally abused me. He had controlled me, in a lot of ways. But I'd just accepted that as a normal part of married life. Mel had taken care of the finances, always. I'd had money available and credit cards, but he'd kept meticulous records, spent lots of time reviewing receipts and questioning purchases. At the time, I'd just thought he was being detail-oriented. But now I see that it was a subtle form of manipulation, of making me both dependent and hesitant to do anything without consulting him. But still within a normal range of marital behavior, or so I'd believed. There had been one part of our lives that was strikingly not normal, but that was a personal, private hell that I'd been forced to relive under police questioning. Was it abuse? Yes, but sexual abuse between married people is a tangled topic at best. Lines blur. Mel liked what he called breath play. He liked to put a cord around my neck and choke me. He'd been careful about using a soft, padded thing that left no real marks behind, and he'd been an expert at its use. I'd hated it, and often talked him out of it. But the one time I'd outright refused, I'd seen a flash of something, darker. I never said no again. He never choked me hard enough to make me pass out, though it had come very close, and I endured it. Over and over, never knowing that while he was starving me for oxygen during sex, he was imagining his women in the garage, fighting the noose as he raised and lowered them off the ground. It might not have been abuse, but there isn't any doubt in my mind that it felt wrong. Looking back, the thought that he was using me to play out his murders over and over again, it's chilling and sickening.
We don't want to be found by someone, I say.
Let's leave it at that, okay?
Javi nods.
I can tell this isn't his first rodeo either. As a range instructor, he's probably seen plenty of frightened women seeking comfort in their own self-defense. He also knows that a gun can't protect you unless you protect yourself mentally, emotionally, and logically. It's the punctuation at the end, not the paragraph.
I am just saying that if you don't have good paper, I know some people,
he says. People who can be trusted. They help out shelter victims starting new lives.
I thank him, but I don't need his trusted strangers. I can't trust them. All I want is the cargo van and the receipts, and I'll be on my way. It's a step toward departing, and I'm sad about it, but I also know it's necessary to be ready. Once I have the van, I have control. We can, if necessary, be